Hey everybody, Scott Horton here. Ever think maybe your group should hire me to give a speech? Well, maybe you should. I've got a few good ones to choose from, including how to end the war on terror, the case against war with Iran, central banking in war, Uncle Sam and the Arab Spring, the ongoing war on civil liberties, and of course, why everything in the world is Woodrow Wilson's fault. But I'm happy to talk about just about anything else you've ever heard me cover on the show as well. So check out youtube.com/ScottHortonShow for some examples, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more details. See you there. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. If you're like me, then you're right all the time, surrounded by people in desperate need of correction. Well, we can't all have a radio show, but we can all get anti-government propaganda to stick on the back of our trucks. Check out LibertyStickers.com. Categories include anti-war, empire, police state, libertarian, Ron Paul, gun rights, founders quotes, and of course, the stupid election. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Ben Franklin said, "Those who are willing to sacrifice essential liberty for a little temporary safety deserve neither." Hi, Scott Horton here for the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's a playing card-sized steel Bill of Rights designed to set off the metal detectors anywhere the police state goes, so you can remind those around you the freedoms we've lost. And for a limited time, get free shipping when you purchase a frequent flyer pack of 5 Bill of Rights Security Edition cards. Play a leading role in the security theater with a Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. The Scott Horton Show is brought to you by the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. Join the great Jacob Hornberger and some of the best writers in the libertarian movement like James Bovard, Sheldon Richman, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and more for a real individualist take on the most important matters of peace, liberty, and prosperity in our society. That's the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Our next guest is Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent in England, independent.co.uk. And he is just back in the British Isles from Syria. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you doing?
Not so bad.
I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad you didn't get kidnapped and have to escape while you were there.
No, I was lucky.
Yeah, well, that's the news, is that Richard Engel is safe, and they're saying he escaped. I haven't read the story yet. Anyway, so welcome back to the show. The piece at The Independent is called Syria, The Descent into Holy War. The world decided to back the rebels last week, but this is no fight between goodies and baddies. Well, first of all, they've been backing the rebels for a while there, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, really from the beginning with the... but more so now with the 130 countries recognizing the Rebels Coalition as being representative of the Syrian people.
Mm-hmm. And then I thought it was kind of funny. I mean, it seems like the politics of this is that the Americans have been called out by you and others so many times now for backing some really extreme holy warrior suicide bomber types, and they're trying to distance themselves from that by, it's seemingly, if I understand it right, they're sort of endorsing this group of exiles and expats and that kind of thing, Chalabis. But then, according to McClatchy newspapers, their expats immediately endorse the suicide bomber guys because they desperately need the credibility of being allied with them. Is that really right? Do I understand that right?
Sure, yeah. It's pretty bizarre. On the one hand, the National Coalition gets recognized as representing Syria. At the same time, on the al-Nusra Front, which is the main fighting force of the coalition inside Syria, is denounced by the U.S. as being a terrorist organization similar to al-Qaeda. And then the National Coalition denounces the U.S. for saying it's a terrorist organization, and there are demonstrations in northern Syria with people shouting, "We are all al-Nusra." But there's no question that this is a hardline, holy war, fundamentalist Islamic organization, good at fighting, but somewhat similar to al-Qaeda. So it's a very bizarre situation.
Yeah, well, so First of all, tell us what you can about these rebels. I mean, I don't want to oversimplify them, because I have been reading things over the last year and a half about how there are a lot of people who really hate this dictator Assad, and they sure would like to see him overthrown. And yet, we do read about suicide bombers, and of course, your article begins with some horrible war crimes being committed by these rebels. What can you tell us about who is really the anti-government side of this war?
The Syrian revolution was originally a genuine revolution. It was an uprising of the mass of the people, particularly from the poorer parts of the country, against a police state and against a dictator. The problem is, in Syria, that unlike Egypt or Tunisia, the regime remained intact. I mean, nobody really defected to the other side. And it quite rapidly turned into an armed insurrection. Now, in Syria, I mean, it's basically run by a minority, the Alawites, who are a type of Shia. The 70% of the country population is Sunni. So somebody can be quite a genuine Democrat, demanding democratic rule and rule by the majority. But this has enormous impact on the distribution of power between different sects of Syrians, between those who are Alawites, who are Christians, who are Druze. So any change was really going to be a revolutionary change in who holds power there. And, you know, we've now had this war that's been going on 20 months and is effectively destroying the country.
And now, we also have been hearing for a long, long time that the regime is on its last legs, and yet it sure doesn't seem to be. How long do you think this can go on?
I mean, that again is peculiar. You know, I remember at the end of 2011 having sort of a meeting with a Middle East leader who said, oh, it may be only a matter of weeks before Assad goes. You know, it hasn't happened. It isn't happening. You hear this pretty well every day. It doesn't, you know, there's a balance of power there. I mean, what I find pretty amazing is people announce this, that the regime is about to go, but if you're in Syria, even look at a map of Syria, the government still holds the main cities and the main towns. You know, the occasional base falls, the rebels make some progress, but most population centers are still in the hands of the government. So I think this is really a sort of an attempt to frighten them, the government, into destabilizing them or splitting them or something like that. But certainly it's very misleading. Of course, people get away with it because there's so few direct eyewitnesses, journalists in Damascus. So almost anything you say about Syria is unprovable. Although if you're actually walking around Damascus, it may be obvious a lot of these things just aren't true.
Okay, now, during the war in Libya, I think the assumption was, even though it took 8 or 9 months, it sort of was clear that as long as NATO is backing the one side over the other, eventually Tripoli's going to fall, kind of a thing. But you're saying in this case it's not that way.
No, I mean, for the reason you just stated. You know, the rebels there, I don't think, would last a few days without air support, you know, from the whole of NATO, with the U.S. in the background. So you had this massive Air Force overhead. And so it was surprising that Gaddafi's people lasted so long.
You know, they have a lot more fighters in Syria, don't they, than they did in Libya?
It's a more populous country, but there are more fighters. But it has, essentially, it hasn't, you know, they don't have the foreign support, which was essential in Libya. And I think that's one thing they're bidding for, and therefore you get these exaggerated claims that they're on the edge of victory. And I think their assumption is that Europeans and others would like to come out on the winning side. But if you're actually in Damascus, you know, a lot of this stuff, you know, is pretty exaggerated. I mean, I drove from Damascus, the capital, up north for about 160 kilometers, 120, 130 miles to Homs. You know, without an escort and so forth, without trouble. In Homs itself, I didn't hear, which is the third biggest city, and I've seen a lot of fighting at the beginning of the year. I didn't hear a shot fired. So, you know, some areas, yes, a lot of heavy fighting, or fairly heavy fighting, but most of the country, most of Damascus, not at all.
So, I guess, you know, I was going to ask you about, you know, what's going to happen if the Baathist government does fall apart? Then it'd be even worse and this and that kind of thing. But it doesn't sound like you think there's any chance that's going to happen at all.
Well, it doesn't seem likely at the moment. You know, the government is really belongs to the Alawite sect. You know, as I was writing a piece last weekend about a video that every single person I met in Damascus had seen, which is of two Alawite officers. I think one was been identified as a general who'd been captured by the rebels, you know, being beheaded like al-Qaeda used to do in Iraq in the street. You know, the first beheading is carried out by an 11 or 12-year-old boy. At the end of it, they sort of hold up the heads as trophies. Now, if you're an Alawite or you're a Christian or you're just associated with the government in the civilian or military part of the government, that sort of thing, you know, really frightens people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the reasons, you know, that they're unlikely to get in.
Right, yeah, it just hardens the opposition's resolve for sure there. And now, so we're reading about terrible deprivation in the country, too. People starving and freezing to death in refugee camps and this kind of thing. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have that in Turkey. You know, it's getting cold there. People were sleeping under the bridges and for reason. I don't see them now. Most of the people have sort of are in with relatives. They've rented houses in Damascus, you know, five or six families to a small house. Some people go to Lebanon, but that's quite expensive, and they come back. The government's been sort of, you know, let's say the rebels see some district. The government opens fire with artillery. The civilian population moves out and moves to other districts. So some districts are completely jam-packed. And you can find this just also in the streets of this, you know, tremendous gridlock of traffic, which is largely, I think, the population of Damascus has soared as refugees come into the city. You see big bread lines outside bakeries, too, again. I think it's maybe not that they're not that they're producing less bread. It's simply there are an awful lot more mouths to feed.
Mm-hmm. And then, I guess the last I heard, there were, 2.5 million Iraqis hiding out in Syria, waiting to come home, because Iraq's still a horrible bloodbath every day, too.
No, I think that they've mostly gone. I mean,
yeah?
They were seeping out, and then when this happened, you know, a lot of them thought, well, it's even more dangerous to stay in Syria than to be in Baghdad. So they've
gone
back to Baghdad, mostly.
They left at the start of this war.
Yeah, I mean, they have been, you know, it's been a gradual process, but it became evident that, you know, Syria is becoming very violent, and Iraqis felt particularly vulnerable because they didn't have any protection, vulnerable to kidnappers and to criminals. So that was another reason they left.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, there's a big problem, right, when politically Western politicians, especially the Americans, and maybe especially the Democrats after talking tough, they have a real hard time backing down, right, and saying, okay, never mind, go ahead and stay in power after I said a year ago you have to go. And so does that mean, do you think, that we're just on a path towards more and more intervention until eventually the airstrikes do begin because they have to, you know, live up to their threat?
It might happen that way. I mean, you know, it seems to me that they've made a mistake in committing themselves to the total victory of the rebels. Well, in the present circumstances, you know, that's committing yourself to supporting one side in a civil war, you know, and pretending that the other side has no support whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
Which was kind of the mistake the U.S. made in Iraq, you know, to demonize Saddam so much and the Ba'ath Party. They sort of had convinced themselves that they could just roll over these guys and there'd be you know, there'd be no response. But, of course, you know, there were people associated with the government, you know, suddenly were politically and economically marginalized. They fought back. That's why you had a war there.
And then there is a lot of news out of Iraq about, you know, killings all over the place. Who's fighting who? Is that still just the same old battle?
It's the same as Sunni v. Shia, and it's sort of, you know, it's sort of, it's remained, it's stable at quite a high level of, quite a high level of violence. But to get back to Syria, if I may,
sure.
I mean, I think one of the problems with Syria is there are very few foreign journalists there. You also notice, you know, the effect on the American media in particular of just the sheer number of The sheer number of American newspapers have gone out of business. So, you know, there are far fewer reporters around. Not all of them were good, but quite a lot of them were good. Mm-hmm. Television covers it less intensely. Now they can't really get into Damascus and Syria, and therefore they take a lot of what the opposition says as face value. And, you know, this has a pretty, I think, disastrous effect on coverage, you know, which is, well, I'm sitting in Damascus reading this stuff in American or European papers or on the wires or watching television. You know, quite a lot of it is fantasy, or it's exaggerated, or it's not quite true.
Mm.
So I think this war is actually being worse reported than Iraq or Libya or Afghanistan.
Right, yeah, this article is actually, and I wasn't sure if it was just my fault for being so busy lately that I hadn't been reading enough or whether it was really a blackout, but you talk in your article here about how the Western media won't cover these the beheading videos. I mean, we do hear about the suicide bombings, although I don't think they usually make a direct connection between this is the side we're on here, quote-unquote we are on here. But the beheadings, I haven't even heard that really discussed other than in your piece here.
Yeah,
in the Independent.
It's extraordinary, but you know, almost everybody in Damascus is talking about it and has seen these things. And now there's not really a mention in the foreign press. I think, but so much of what they get is dependent on, getting figures and facts from the opposition. Now, partly this is, the government won't let them give them visas to go to Damascus, and partly because they're short on resources or maybe a bit slothful. We've had this. I was saying my feeling is it's rather as if we in Britain were trying to report an American presidential election, but we couldn't get visas to go to the U.S. So we relied entirely on Republican Party militants for our information about what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And even a lot of those militants, let's say, if we're making comparison with the Syrian ones, not in the U.S., but in Mexico or in Canada. That's really the parallel. Would one then have a narrative, an account of the American presidential election that was anywhere near the truth? The answer is not.
Yeah.
But that's pretty obvious. But in Syria, people go right ahead and basically get their reporting from an exiled opposition, and they repeat it as fact.
Yeah, and especially on TV, that's what matters the most. Is, just the narrative, and that's what fills in the gap of the information. And, of course, so as it's reported by the anchors, everybody's on the side of the poor, downtrodden, good guy, underdog rebels against the bad, bad government there. All TV media executives in America know that, and their anchors do, too. And so even if it came up that, there's been some beheadings, where it's not going to push them off track from the story that they're selling, ultimately, which is that we intervene, we'll stop the violence.
It already is pretty terrible, and even Al Jazeera, which is very much sort of anti the government, but even that feels it, it's necessary at times, to have really quite damning reports from the north about the rebels. I saw, a couple in the last few days on Al Jazeera, one from Aleppo with people in the streets saying, look, we didn't like Assad when he was here, but the new lot are 100 times worse. And also, I saw one about a Shia village near Idlib, which had been sort of taken over by this Al-Qaeda group, Al-Nusra, who had just simply driven everybody out. So, it's rather amazing that even Al Jazeera, which is very committed to the rebel side, does produce these documentaries, while U.S. television is sort of largely, and British television is largely silent on this.
Mm. It's amazing that those Sunni fighters didn't learn from their experience in the Iraq War how counterproductive it was to alienate their potential base so badly when they're fighting against their enemies,
Yeah. It's to show they're merciless, to show they're tough.
Right.
To show, don't mess with us, Of course, it creates a lot of enemies, but it also frightens a lot of people. Do you want to frighten?
if I remember right, when the real fighting broke out, I think I had assembled some sort of consensus here on the show between you and Pepe Escobar that really, you know, if you saw the business class of Sunni Arabs in Aleppo, you know, defect and join the side and really support the rebellion, then it might have stood a chance. But it was already clear almost a year ago that that wasn't going to happen, right?
Yeah, that there was sort of great divisions and so forth, and the government wasn't falling. You know, this was some of this is in the nature of Syria, sectarian divisions within Syria, but quite a lot can be blamed on the U.S. and the West Europeans, notably Britain, of, you know, backing the rebels for as a winner. I think what you've got to do is damp things down, look for a transitional government, and also I think you've got to, you know, defuse this as a sort of Shia Sunni confrontation or as an attempt to weaken Iran, which it quite certainly is. You know, otherwise they're a pretty peculiar thing to have a campaign with the, led by the U.S. for democracy in Syria, but the big ally is Saudi Arabia and Qatar, that are two of the few remaining completely absolute monarchies in the world whose interest in democracy for anybody is presumably pretty slight.
Yeah.
So, you know, so there's lots of contending agendas in here.
Now,
and I think it's, you know, it's, the reporting's been very simple-minded.
Right. Well, you know, I wonder whether the National Security Council guys actually just sort of see it that way and thought maybe it would be a good idea to encourage the rebels by saying Assad must step down, which is another way of saying the rebels must win, at least eventually, so don't negotiate. But maybe they like it right where they've got it, whereas you describe, Assad's not really going to fall, but he sure does have this sort of unending armed insurgency to fight, which sure is crippling, you know, any other thing he'd be up to, which I don't know what they'd be worried about.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's been sort of a bit bizarre from the beginning, you know, that you hear all from all over accounts of how Assad should step down in his last legs. But as I said, why the hell should he do that when he controls most of the population centers of Syria still and a large army, suddenly a larger army than the one on the other side?
Right, but it encourages the rebels to never negotiate in their first...
Yeah, but if you could get, let's say you could get, you know, air cover from NATO or active military intervention, then of course you'd be on a winner. So there'd be there's no reason to compromise. But that, I think, is really what's so negative about certainly American and European policy, that by tempting the rebels with the idea that we might come and aid you militarily, that you give them an incentive to absolutely not negotiate. I mean, I don't want to sound too sort of... by pointing out the weaknesses of the rebels, I don't want to give the impression that the government are a much maligned bunch of good guys. They aren't. You know, this was a cruel and greedy police state. But to think of it as just sort of black hats and white hats, I think is simple-minded and very deceptive.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of these rebel fighters are going around doing suicide bombings and cutting off people's heads, is that also another way of saying they are never going to give up either? This thing could go on for a long, long time.
Well, people who are committed like that generally don't give up, which is why they make pretty good soldiers, you know. And they're the sort of effective fighting force, you know, but they've been fighting up in Aleppo at one base there, I think, which has mostly fallen. About 2,000 men attacking about 350 soldiers who basically have nothing much to eat, but were fighting to the last bullet, you know, because they think they don't have any alternative. So I think, you know, it might be at one point the rebels might win, but I would have thought it would be in the long term, and I don't think there'd be much of Syria left by that time.
Yeah, and then that's like where the real nightmare begins, right, is when everything just kind of, you know, like when Iraq fell, it wasn't like the Shiites inherited Saddam's government, right? They completely replaced it, and they had to start over from scratch with all the
killing. Yeah, the Americans completely replaced it. They dissolved the Ba'ath Party, who weren't allowed to have a job in the state if you have been in the Ba'ath Party. And then to their amazement, they discovered that these guys were really angry, you know. A lot of people in the Iraqi army thought they hadn't fought the invasion, whether there was a sort of understanding with the U.S. They didn't fight. You know, they'd still be an Iraqi army afterwards, not Saddam, but an Iraqi army. Then they find, you know, I remember just meeting, you know, majors in special forces who were selling that furniture to feed their children. Now, when people are reduced to that area of desperation, you know, they'll fight pretty hard. Mm. If they're particularly well-experienced, well-trained soldiers, you know, they'll do a lot of damage.
All right, well, tell me this. What other reporters working on Syria do you respect and would you recommend that people read?
Liz Sly.
Uh-huh.
S-L-Y. She's the Washington Post correspondent in Beirut. And I think she's pretty good. I don't think, frankly, that the New York Times has the quality of its coverage has recovered from the death of Anthony Shadid earlier this year. You may recall that he died getting into Syria from an asthma attack. But I think he did have a pretty balanced and intelligent idea of what was going on. Other than that, there isn't a great deal. There are some websites, Joshua Landis, for instance, who's an expert at Oklahoma University. I've always found that pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of draws together all the best of the writings on Syria. And I think his judgment is pretty good. And some of this is in pretty obscure places. So, I mean, there is stuff that comes out. What one really wants, you know, it's really simple, Scott. I mean, as you know yourself, is, you know, you want people who've actually been in Syria, been in Damascus, who can say, you know, I saw this, I saw that. You know, you want eyewitness testimony. What you don't want is sort of people in Beirut or Washington or London or somewhere else reporting second or third hand, citing opposition sources that are obviously partisan. Mm-hmm. This really gives an extraordinarily skewed picture of what goes on there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, David Enders has done some brave work, and he keeps getting out alive and uncaptured as well.
Yeah, I'm a bit surprised by that, but he's, yeah, I know he is extremely brave, and there are other good people around. I mean, there always are a few, and that's true of Syria, you know, as it was of Iraq.
Apparently, poor old Austin Tice is still being held there, right?
Yes. You know, it's a dangerous place. It's dangerous from both the government and rebel side, and it's dangerous because of criminality. And again, there's a parallel with Iraq here. People notice it when correspondents get kidnapped. They don't notice that, you know, there's a whole kidnap industry there. When last Sunday I was up in a Christian village called Malula, and he has about 3,000 people in it, but, you know, they'd had 4 kidnaps recently. One guy had resisted when they had a pistol, and a local businessman had been shot 3 times, you know, pretty badly. So, you know, I remember in Iraq, long before foreigners got kidnapped, Iraqis were being kidnapped everywhere. It just didn't get reported much.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm sorry we're all out of time, but I thank you so much for your time, as always. I really appreciate it, Patrick.
No, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Everybody, that's the great Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. That's independent.co.uk. The recent article here, most recent, Syria, the descent into holy war. About the beheadings and suicide bombings of the Western and Saudi and Qatari-backed rebels there. And also, he's the author of the book Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite Revival and the Future of Iraq, which is so important. I really suggest that you take a look at that thing. It's an incredible piece of work. We'll be right back here in just a little while. In an empire where Congress knows nothing, the ubiquitous D.C. think tank is all. And the Israel lobby and their neocon allies must own a dozen. Well, Americans have a lobby in Washington, too. It's called the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They advocate for us on Capitol Hill. Join CNI to demand an end to the U.S.-sponsored occupation of the Palestinians and an end to our government's destructive empire in the Middle East. That's the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, ladies, Scott Horton here. If you would like truly youthful, healthy, and healthy-looking skin, there is one very special company you need to visit, Dagny & Lane, at dagnyandlane.com. Dagny & Lane has revolutionized the industry with a full line of products made from organic and all-natural ingredients that penetrate deeply with nutrient-rich ionic minerals and antioxidants for healthy and beautiful skin. That's Dagny & Lane at dagnyandlane.com. And for a limited time, add promo code SCOTT15 at checkout for a 15% discount. Hey folks, Scott Horton here for Veterans for Peace at veteransforpeace.org. I'm not a vet, but if you are, I'd like to ask you to consider joining Veterans for Peace. As you know, in matters of foreign wars, a veteran's voice is given much more weight. Well, Veterans for Peace is making veterans' voices heard in ways and places where they can really make a difference. There are more than 175 chapters of Veterans for Peace in all 50 states, working hard to eliminate nuclear weapons, seek justice for veterans and victims of war, and abolish war as an instrument of American national policy. It's the peace vets versus the chicken hawks. Join up the good fight at veteransforpeace.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here. After the show, you should check out one of my sponsors, WallStreetWindow.com. It's a financial blog written by Mike Swanson, a former hedge fund manager who's investing in commodities, mining stocks, and European markets. Mike's site, WallStreetWindow.com, is unique in that he shows people what he's really investing in, updating you when he buys or sells in his main account. Mike's betting his positions are going to go up due to the Federal Reserve printing all that money to finance the deficit. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.